Welcome to the Enneagram 2.0 podcast. I'm Beatrice Chastain.
And I'm Uranio Pais.
And today we are talking about common misconceptions about the instincts connected to the Enneagram system of personality.
Very glad we're talking about this, finally. I think it's a super important and timely theme. And would you mind explaining why we decided to talk about this, Bea?
Yeah, through the course of our teaching and interacting with people, the emails we get from people, we notice that there seems to be a lot of misunderstanding about what it means to have a particular instinct that's dominant. And we think this is partly because people are going based on particular definitions of like what it means to be self-preservation or social or sexual dominant, and not really understanding what the way that actually plays out in the personality, because as we say, the instincts are distorted in the personality.
Yeah, so lots of stereotyping happens out there. And we get concerned at times, and we think that clarifying things a little bit is a good idea.
Yeah, and also I think it just it creates a lot of confusion. A lot of times the question from a person is, you know, I relate to this subtype description, but I'm confused about the instinct because, like, I think I'm a social six, but I relate more to the self-preservation description. Or I think I'm a social four, but I have all these what I think are self-preservation qualities or sexual qualities. And the thing is, I think what people don't get is, for instance, self-preservation is not about self-care. Like, people will say, well, I don't really take very good care of myself, so I can't be a self-preservation dominant. And the definition of being self-preservation dominant for some types is not taking care of yourself, right? It's not the same thing as self-care, because the personality is something that defends us but doesn't necessarily act in our best interest when it comes to what's really, truly good for us. So sometimes our personality is something that leads to self-defeating behaviors or self-destructive behaviors, not something that's supportive of our well-being or even our, especially our growth and evolution.
Right. So for self-pressed dominance also, I think, as an example, it happens with all three. I think many people end up doing more shallow things related to self-pressed than truly taking care of themselves. And what you said applies to the other two instincts. So socials, for instance, sometimes they are more antisocial when they are social dominance. Is this what you mean?
Yeah, and why don't we, you know, because we're already getting into some examples, why don't we take each of the three instincts one at a time and talk a little bit about what it is, how it often plays out in the context of the personality type, and what the common misconceptions are, so that we can hopefully provide some clarity for people. And again, the goal is to help people find their actual subtype and help them gain insight into themselves through knowing what their dominant instinct is and their whole instinctual sequence, which again can be kind of hard to do given that they're, you know, what do you pay attention to? The subtype description, the instinct description, which instinct description, how do you put it all together? So I think we're trying to provide some help for people who are trying to understand themselves in terms of these important concepts.
Yeah, and eventually we decided to teach our students that it's easier and better, more accurate to identify what their subtypes are and then see what the dominant instinct is, right, as a consequence, and not the other way around. But I agree. Let's start talking about type by type. And I invite you to start, Bea. I think you have a lot to say. Not type by type, but
yeah, instinct by instinct. Yeah, so let's talk about the self-preservation instinct first. right? So what is it actually when, and again, we're talking, the concept of instinct is a big one, and we could talk about it from different fields of study, but we're talking about it in terms of the aspect of the Enneagram system that relates to this idea that we are animals, you know, and we have instinctual drives in us, just like animals, survival, biological survival drives. But in the context of the human personality, and again, we remember, we go a lot from Gurdjieffian theory about the centers of intelligence and the instincts and things like that. So that's a lot of what we base this on. It's not purely a kind of a scientific approach, although certainly there's a lot of overlap with modern science. But basically the self-preservation instinct is a survival drive that is, again, in a very fast, impulsive, animalistic way, kind of focused on how can I survive here? How can I, you know, live another day? How can I be okay and safe? And how can I find what I need to survive, to move forward? And, but we have to remember in the context of the personality, it mixes up with our lower emotional center, our lower mental center. And these centers are always kind of talking to each other. And so there's a distortion of the pure instinct that we might think of as self-preservation, as we might find it, say, in an animal in the wild. You know, it might be in a more pure form in that animal who doesn't have sort of the human personality and the brain and that we have. So in the context of personality, self-preservation, in a very loose way of speaking, and again, we can't generalize too much because as soon as we start talking about the types, it's going to look different because it's interacting with a different passion, a different fixation, a different overall constellation of personality traits. But generally, self-preservation is about what that personality thinks they need to do to survive. And it's a more self-focus. The self-preservation dominance, we sometimes say, can be a little bit more selfish as an unconscious response to things because their focus is a little bit more on themselves and not as much on the social world or on other people, and not as much on other individuals. So that's how, what else would you say by definition of the self-preservation instinct? In terms of there's not much we can say that applies to everything before we start stereotyping, but what else would you say, if anything?
Well, in a more general comment, I think we in the Enneagram community, we need to evolve to talk less about behavioral traits and more about the core issues behind things and what is more hidden. So I think you and I try to talk more about dimensions of the instincts that are psychological, spiritual, historic, collective, and somatic. And all that a dominant instinct carries underneath behavior. But when it comes to behavior, I think that you mentioned the word that is key, which is survival. There is this unconscious fear that I'm not going to survive, many times associated with early trauma. And that gets acted out in different ways for different people. And many times in small things, which is true, like if I may give an example of you, because you are a self-pressed dominant, it's really not common that you leave home without an umbrella because of your self-pressed dominant. But I know so many people who are self-pressed dominants that don't have the same particular habit. We got a student the other day saying that they couldn't be a self-pressed one because they are not very organized when it comes to put dishes in the dishwasher. And that is such a silly example that I don't think we should ever mention. It's so specific, right?
Right. I think very foundationally, the self-preservation instinct, once we start talking about which type you are, we start to see the distortions, right? And so it's not that you cannot decide your self-preservation dominant if, for instance, and we hear this all the time, like, oh, I like to be comfortable. I like to be warm enough. I like to have enough food. I take care of myself when I go on a trip because I bring all these things that I need. That's not what self-preservation instinct is. It can be sometimes for some people, but for instance, very quickly, like for self-preservation, for me as a self-preservation too, self-preservation instinct starts making me focus on being liked, right? Mm-hmm. Being liked or making a positive impression on people, right? And almost like as an instinctive thing, it's because at a deep level, it's like, if other people, if you think about it like as a child, from the point of view of a child, if other people aren't thinking well of me, they won't take care of me. It's a little bit like that, right? For a one, for instance, the self-preservation one, it becomes about doing every little thing right. Because if I don't do every little thing right, something bad will happen. And one of those bad things could be I could make a mistake or someone could get mad at me and punish me. You know, a lot of other things start coming into the field of experience in terms of the way that the instinct actually plays out in our life experience and through our personality patterns. And I think I want to mention behavior because you said this. I think it's important to remember that even though, like Uranio said, the instinct is connected to much more than just behavior, at the same time, when you're trying to figure out your subtype or your dominant instinct, a lot of what you will want to notice is behaviors. And now again, we need to be careful about interpreting behaviors because you may say, but my behavior is that I take a lot on trips with me, or I always have enough something in my refrigerator. But you can do that and not be self-preservation dominant. That's the point, that what makes you self-preservation dominant is more explicitly how that plays out in the context of your whole personality, because the personality, the head center, the lower head center, the heart center, the other behavioral factors are going to be combining with and distorting the way your instinct gets expressed.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that the behavioral part gets more accurate in the subtype level and not the instinct level. Because it's very rare that we see pure instinct in action. And by definition, the centers of intelligence in the first levels of awareness and personality are mixed up. And one is stealing energy from the other. So it's important to look at behavior more in the subtype level. But as soon as we find out the behavioral patterns, and we work a little bit on those to contain those patterns, then we need to go underneath and see those other dimensions. This is my main point. Now, I also think that on top of the very important thing you said about each type and how the instinct happens for each type, there are some misconceptions on the instinct study in itself. So, for instance, when people stereotype saying, as you said, that a self-pressed dominant packs lots of different things just in case when they're going to travel, that doesn't apply to you at all as a self-pressed dominant. And you want to have a lighter bag. You carry way less things than I carry in trips, that business trips that I do. And as a matter of fact, I heard you say once that would never cross my mind, which is I need to have a lighter bag if something happens and I need to run away, right? So that's another way that instinct plays out for you in specific, and it may be very different for other self-pressed dominants.
Yeah, it's so funny. I think of you and how, and your whole family actually, and how each of you has three large suitcases when you go somewhere. And I think I literally have had the thought in my mind, what if there is a bomb in the airport and you have to run? Like, there's no way you're taking all your bags with you. I have one bag and a backpack, and so I can easily run away.
Well, that in my family is explained by another kind of subtype, which is Brazilian. You know, the Brazilians carry too much load and they pack too much and they take bags because they shop a lot wherever they go. So, yeah.
They bring a lot of presents to everybody they know.
Yes.
Yes. So another few more examples about self-preservation. So for instance, another great example is a good friend of mine is a self-preservation nine. And I've told this story before, but he one time said, he said, you know, how can I be self-pres dominant? Because I don't really keep my apartment very clean. I don't wash my dishes. I can sort of not take care of myself in those ways a lot. And that's a really good example because self-preservation dominants don't necessarily take care of themselves in that way. That again, it's not about self-care, it's about survival, right? And so I asked him, what are you doing while you're not washing your dishes? And he said, oh, I'm watching hockey. You know, he loves watching sports. So self-preservation nines are focused on comfort and comforting activities almost as a substitute for the real kind of taking care of themselves that sloth makes them forget about, right? So it's more about what are the, I like how you said that, that the behavior patterns are based on the subtype because the subtype is the dominant instinct embedded in your personality. It's combined with the lower emotional motivations that are conditioned since childhood from experience, which is a mixture of your type-based reactions to things and what you experienced in life. And so I think there's a way that you need to think about that. You know, self-preservation eights, really good at getting what they need, but in very particular ways. They have methods of getting what they need that I would never engage in because they're so much more direct and assertive than I am as a two. As a self-preservation two, part of why there's a lot of focus on relationship is that at a sort of deep unconscious level, I'm kind of programmed of like, I need other people to take care of me because I'm a little bit stuck in at an early stage of childhood where I might not have had that experience of getting taken care of. And so I often say like in my early, it's a lot of the things that we point to as self-preservation dominant are things I had to learn. Like when I was in my teens, 20s, even into my 30s, I wasn't very good at paying bills or paying for things, or I would spend much more money than I had. I would overindulge myself in certain ways and completely not take care of myself in other ways. So again, this is a much more complicated picture that we need to always keep in mind and not throw the subtypes out the window and just focus on the instinctual definitions, because those definitions can too easily get misconstrued, misperceived as sort of taking care of myself in a very sort of set way, stereotypical way. That's just not the case for so many of the actual personality subtypes.
And what you've just said about money and self-pres dominant, that in your case, you're not having controls or saving too much. That is another good example of how we should not stereotype. Now, something else that I hear from, you know, some definitions out there talking about self-preservation instinct is that they can have less and not only in saving, but also in living a more minimalistic life. In different ways, like going without, just because they are more economical in not only in the financial way. So I want to say that to me doesn't apply to sevens, to eights, to threes when they are self-pressed dominance, because you know, it's not something as easy for those types. And I think it creates lots of confusion for people of those types, right?
Yeah.
And I was going to ask you, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to ask you to explain even more of that for Self-Press, talking again about Self-Press 4, because I think it's a great example and also something that still needs some clarification in the Enneagram field.
Yes, and we also have to remember that when we're talking about the Enneagram system and the types and subtypes, there's so much paradox in here. Right. And I think sometimes when we get too concrete too quickly about what it means to have a dominant instinct, we lose all the nuance and paradox that is so much a part of the Enneagram. So self-preservation four, I think, is a great example. The self-preservation four is almost the opposite of what we might think of as self-care. Right. When someone is, I've heard many self-preservation fours saying, when they're trying to find their subtype, saying, but I can't be a self-preservation four because I don't take care of myself. I don't take care of my health or my body. And that is the definition of self-preservation four. They kind of go against self-care and they unconsciously kind of make life more difficult for themselves. They make a virtue of enduring hardship, right? They're masochistic. And this is a big blind spot, right? So self-preservation fours have to learn a little bit about this subtype before they, you know, push it away, because they may think, well, I'm not masochistic. And they may, in some, you may not be masochistic in all ways, but there's this sense of the self-preservation survival instinct in self-preservation fours is about proving to others how strong I am, how much I can take it. You know, it's as Naranjo said, and I love this, it's the child saying to the mother, do you see how I'm not crying, how I'm not a burden? Do you love me now? Like earning love and care from others and earning connection through being strong and stoic and not complaining and not sharing their emotions that might be a problem for other people, right? The other fours share emotions that sometimes make other people have problems with them, right? That's just natural part of their personality. And again, no value judgment on that. But the self-preservation four goes the other way. And in sort of senses as they're growing up in a survival way of, if I'm too sad, if I'm too angry, if I'm too much in pain, I get rejected by the people around me. So I need to endure that myself inside without complaining, without crying, without sharing my pain with other people. So the self-preservation instinct manifests in fours by them being tough and strong and not complaining, which often means dealing with not getting what they need in terms of self-care and moving ahead anyway, boldly, strongly, courageously. But again, when they're on a growth path, then they need to engage in self-care, because they so don't when they're in their normal personality pattern, when they're stuck in their habitual self-preservation four thing, they don't take care of themselves, right? And so this is a great example, as you said, of how sometimes the subtype can be the opposite of what we think the dominant instinct will lead to.
Yeah, thank you for this explanation. It's super important and a very good example. Is there anything else you want to say about the self-press instinct and misconceptions?
I guess I'll say, you know, there are, I think, things that are a little bit true of all nine when it comes to being a little more fearful than the other types, having a little more anxiety than the other types, and in some ways being a little more warm and friendly than the other types. But again, we need to hold that lightly. because it may not hold true for all nine, even while there may be like a six that's more warm and friendly, more fearful, a one that's more warm and friendly and fearful being self-preservation. So these are things, again, that sometimes can hold true for several of the subtypes with one with the same dominant instinct. But again, even then, let's hold it a little bit lightly, because a lot of self-preservation eights, for instance, aren't very warm. And sometimes they may not be in touch with their fear, although they will tend to be a little more fearful, cautious, prone to anxiety than the other two eights.
Yeah.
Right. But again, we need to always hold it lightly and think of the three subtypes of one type and not compare apples with oranges, as they say.
Yeah, I agree. And I also think self-pressed seven is not the warmest seven, and self-pressed three is not the warmest three. And the same way that sometimes people describe correctly to an extent that sexuals are hot, but it's not the case of most sexual threes, at least in the beginning of their growth process, sometimes sexual nine. Right. And so that varies a lot. And not all socials are just cool and cold, as sometimes we try to say they are. I think that social threes definitely many times don't look cold. They can be experienced cold when you know them more, but depending on where they are not like that. And also social sevens, the counter type of seven, I don't think these are especially cold subtypes. But
so Uranio is referring to the fact that sometimes we say that self-preservations are warm, socials are cool or cold, and sexuals are hot. I just wanted to clarify that because some people may not have heard that.
Yeah, and I think what you say of holding those descriptions lightly is important, is accurate, and more like some tendencies that not always happen. And so we cannot stop there in our work with instincts, and we need to consider the subtype dimension. Anything else about the self-presby?
No, I'm thinking, why don't we move on to talking about the social instinct?
Okay, would you like to start?
Sure. So the typical thing that you hear from people who, again, have maybe not heard the most sophisticated approach to the instincts, or have heard from in certain sources, and again, it's understandable that we would hear the word social and think, oh, this person likes to be social, likes to be sociable, likes to be in groups, but that's not what it means. Right? The social instinct is about surviving as part of a tribe, right? We are social animals. Throughout history, there were eras of history where you did not survive if you weren't in a tribe. There's a saying that there was a line from one of the later episodes of Game of Thrones that I really liked, between Sansa and Arya Stark. And they were talking about how they stuck together as a family. And especially, I think they had just killed someone who was trying to put them against each other. And they quoted their father, their late father, who said, you know, it's the wolf who's in a pack who survives, right? It's that kind of thing. It's like surviving in connection with other people. And that's more complicated and sophisticated than just, I like to be in a group. I join a lot of groups. I feel comfortable in the middle of a group. I'm very social and I'm outgoing, and I like to talk to people in social interaction. So that's what the misconception is that it's often that in a kind of simplistic, straightforward way. And that's not what we mean by the social instinct in the context of the Enneagram. Because when we look at how the social instinct plays out when it mixes in the personality, and the best place to see that is in the subtype descriptions, we note that there are several social dominant types that have a much more complex relationship with groups and social relationships. And often, again, it's paradoxical. Some social dominants may not feel comfortable in groups or may not always be very social, but you're social dominant. So I don't want to talk too long before I hear from what you think about this.
Yeah, as a social five, if I'm not compared to other fives, I many times can be seen as not being sociable. And so it's a tricky description for a five. But then there are other social dominants that are not necessarily sociable also. So social six, for instance, they may feel very technical, straight to the point at times, or, you know, more dutiful than actually sociable. They may have sociable moments, but I see all the time social sixes detaching from that and then missing it. Sometimes people stereotype social dominance as if they were the social two, right? Which is many, many times out there networking or the social three. So it's not like that for a social six. And then social one disconnects a little bit from the group to be a role model and feels that they're not adaptable to that group. And social fours, although deep inside from the social instinct, they wish to be in the group, they are the fours that are the least in the group many times because they fear that they will be less and that they won't fit in. So they go a step back. So it's very relative, especially for social dominance, I'd say, maybe even more than for self-pressed dominance. I think it's a misconcept that it's about groups only. There is this instinctual desire in the inside. It is something important. So there is some truth to it, but it's dangerous to make it about being in groups. Yeah, so do you agree with these examples?
Yeah, those are good examples. I think it's, again, the relationship between the instinct and how it manifests in the personality is a little more complex. So there's a way that the social dominant instinct is a lot more, I find, about like almost what's my relationship to others? And, you know, how do I relate as a default to others? You know, as you're saying, with the one, they tend to unconsciously set themselves above in being a role model or teaching the right way. You know, the social two wants to have influence and be admired, and so has an easy time seducing a lot of people. So that's a little bit more what we would think of. But at the same time, there's a lot of ways that pride is getting acted out in the way social twos interact with others, both in needing to have control over things, wanting to tell people the way they should be done, needing to be seen in a certain way, and not being able to be more vulnerable, more readily. There's the social nine that just works super hard to earn belonging unconsciously and looks like a three even because they can be such a workaholic. But that's very different than, say, a social seven, that their outlook is much more on how do I take the pain away from the world, and almost sacrificing themselves for an ideal of service to others. Not all types are doing that, but they're all doing something. And it's a variation on this. It's not that all socials are kind of regarding groups or social relationships in the same way. It's very nuanced and different. And so important to get that it's not just about comfort with groups at all.
Yeah. Yes, yes. And just before we move on to sexual, I want to say that if the person is doing a good job in inner work and self-development, chances are that things will start not to go so well in that dominant instinct life sphere. because the person necessarily gets deconstructed. So, for instance, a social dominant will start not fitting in or being rejected in the group and so forth, because it's almost like life is coming to that person and saying, break away from that social identity you have. So if you get someone in that stage of life, maybe those people will not see themselves as having that dominant instinct, but it's a point in the journey that makes that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it makes so much sense that you need to take the instinct together with the type. Like I'm thinking of you being a social dominant. I think there are some ways that it makes a lot of sense. Like, for instance, how knowledgeable you are and how you're comfortable being on stage and being kind of going with the flow and talking about things. But then in other ways that people might ascribe to social dominance, you don't look very social dominant. Like, you're the first one who wants to leave the party. at the end of, I bought you that t-shirt that says, is whatever this is almost over, because yeah. It's a joke that, you're always looking at your watch. How soon can I leave and be alone? And so I think that those are two different aspects. And I'm also thinking about the time that in when we were in the IEA, that you used to get people telling you that you weren't a five, you're a three. Right. And I think people, again, we need to sort of sharpen up our categories, hopefully all 27, the subtype categories, to understand, because I think those give us the clearest and most accurate picture of what someone's type actually is. Because a lot of people look at you and say, that's not a five, but I think you, knowing you as I do, I know that you are.
Right. And by the way, thanks a lot for being such a good friend on the path, saying all of this publicly, because you're giving away my secrets in ways that are really useful for my deconstruction.
That's very nice of you to say. You're welcome.
Okay, so yeah, so should we move on to sexual dominance?
Yeah, let's talk about sexual dominance. So I'll start with what I think is a common misconception. And that is, I hear this all the time and have for a long time, that I'm sexual if I make intense eye contact with people and if I prefer one-to-one relationships or interactions than being in a group or being by myself. And I can't tell you how many people that aren't sexual dominants might say they like one-on-one interactions, or they prefer them, or they make intense eye contact. That's not a high enough bar to be a sexual. For instance, as a self-preservation too, for a long time, one of my biggest reactions in groups was to find one person and have an intense conversation, because that's what made me feel safer in that group. Isn't to be by myself, or isn't just to start talking to people. It's to find one person I feel safe with and often have a very engaged conversation. And sometimes I wouldn't talk to anybody else. I just talked to that one or two people that I already knew, that I already knew I liked. And so as a heart type also, that could make me feel like, and in the beginning, when I was first studying the Enneagram, I did think I was sexual dominant. And so it doesn't depend on a kind of preference for one-on-one interaction. It doesn't depend on a kind of ability to kind of have an intense eye contact with people. That's just too shallow a definition, I think, especially when we think of the different types and how it mixes together. But what would you say about the sexual instinct?
Well, in what you said, it's interesting, because I think that what you consider to be intensity in those conversations is not necessarily what sexual dominance mean about it. It's almost like for someone like you, it might almost be enough that the conversation itself is intense. While for sexual dominance, it's always a mean to produce a big intensity in the bonding of the two people in there. So that is very specific and very hard to explain to someone and allow the person to see the difference and own their dominant instinct correctly. Same way heart types are many times thinking they're sexual dominance just because they want to connect, but that's more a heart thing, and they are more relational. And that is a big misconception that we see all the times people getting it wrong. Or people that think that they are sexual dominance because they really like to be close together to a partner. But that sometimes is self-press, needing to feel protected. And the sexual instinct is not about just romance. It's more about the intensity of things. And it's even more, it's more about sexuality itself than other things. But also that makes things complicated, because this doesn't necessarily mean that the sexual dominants are more into sex itself. Sometimes it's also the self-pressed dominant of some types that have more of the sexual compulsion, because it's more the mechanical thing. So it's very hard to stereotype, right? Do you see it the same way?
Right. Yeah, and I also think that we often say it's also not just about sex, but sometimes I think we don't clarify, well, what is it other than sex, you know? And I think part of it is a kind of ability to initiate, an assertiveness, a generativity, like creativity, I think often can have that kind of energy of the energy that creates new things, that brings things forward, that moves toward people. That's like, sometimes we say that, especially sexual twos, but some sexual subtypes are like good at flirting. It's good at sort of dancing on the edges of getting to know someone, but in a way that's not back and forth. It's more for moving forward toward, and also available for a kind of deep connection, that doesn't have to be sexual, but that of course, also necessarily is part of the definition.
Yeah, and I think it's a lot about competition with the rivals and being above the rivals, being better than the rivals. Yeah. And that you need to look very closely to if you want to test if you're sexual dominant. If you don't have that, it's not probable that you're sexual dominant. And also I think that there are different kinds of bonding and connecting, that's not, real sex. Although for sexual dominance, one might argue that, many different things, have some kind of erotic or sensual, at least, connotation, but it doesn't need to become anything concrete for sexual dominance. And sometimes sexual dominance may find it even harder to make it about sex for some types. Now,
and I think especially for type seven, in that's a good example of that Naranjo used to say that the self-preservation seven was actually the seven who might be seen as more promiscuous. Yeah. Whereas the sexual seven could be satisfied with the perfume of romance.
Yeah.
And I think it's not, you know, again, it's really clear. We're not talking about romantic relationship. We're talking about the sexual instinct, but there is a way that if we start looking at the different sexual subtypes, we see that there are some of these differences.
Right. And actually he said the very same about nines. What else do you want to add about sexual?
So I think being impactful is something that is, you know, and they tend to have an easy way of being impactful, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think that what you said about the beating out the rival is really the core of it. And if we think of it that way, we can also see how there are these nine different ways that the sexual instinct manifests in the nine different types. And that's why you're not always going to have one way that it looks that the sexual instinct sort of results in behavior. The sexual four is one way. The sexual nine is completely another way. The sexual seven is another way.
Right. And just one last stereotype that I want to address. You know, people who say sexuals look into other people's eyes and don't divert. Well, good luck finding a sexual seven that stays for long looking into your eyes. You know, it's not like that. It's not something that should be stereotyped. Or a sexual five, right. Or even a sexual nine, you know.
Right, exactly. All of these are good examples of sexual dominance that may not look the way that you think they look when you have this more limited definition of what it means to have that sexual instinct as the dominant one.
Right.
Any other examples or comments to?
I think these were good enough, and we hope that these were sharp, straight to the point, and that you, as our listener, you are reflecting about potential stereotypes, because all of us have those. B and I are always constantly reviewing our work to get rid of stereotypes also.
Yeah. So hopefully too, this is providing more clarity around the instincts and the way the instincts kind of interact with or manifest through the personality. All right.